Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. Today, Conversations with Remarkable Minds. The topic, the Dark Age of America, climate change, cultural collapse, and difficult futures are ahead of us. My guest, John Michael Greer from Cumberland, Maryland. John Michael Greer is one of America's most insightful philosophers, historians of ideas, a futurist, an independent scholar, environmentalist, an expert in energy and peak oil studies, a prolific author. His analysis of the rise and fall of civilizations and the limits of technology and the idea of progress have been recommended by numerous peer-reviewed journals and magazines. The Futurist magazine has called his portrayal of the rise and collapse of civilization as one of the more realistic analyses one can find. John is regarded as one of the most influential figures in the peak oil community. And his weekly blog, The Archdruid Report, is widely read for his commentaries on nature, spirituality, sustainable culture, and critiques on postmodern industrial civilization. He's published more than 30 books. His most recent, Dark Age America, Climate Change, Cultural Collapse, and Hard Future Ahead, that is being reviewed as one of the most realistic views of the future currently in print. His website is thearchdruidreport.blogspot.com. Nice to have you with us today, John.
It's a pleasure to be on. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to begin with you giving us a large overview of how your research and insights into possible future scenarios, but not too far future, meaning from this moment forward over the next 10 to 15 years, and with, for some people that would be a long time, because if you take it too far in the future, they say it's irrelevant, doesn't affect me, I'll be dead by then, so what do I care? We're saying you better care because it's now. And not only are you going to be talking about America, but also Western civilization and the culture in general, and how it's related to your observations into historical cycles that past empires have encountered. And understanding these cycles and their distinguishing characteristics can guide us in critiquing our own place in history at this moment. And there have been many different attempts to define these stages of birth to death of civilizations, such as the writing of Hegel, of Oswald Spengler, Sorokin, and more recently of David Corton and yourself. So before we look at the demise of the U.S. as an empire and our culture's eventual entry into the area of what you define as the Dark Age, I feel it would be wise to start by providing an overview of the distinguishing stages of a civilization's cycle of ascendancy, its apex, and eventual collapse. And how does looking at the history of a civilization cyclically differ from neoliberal capitalist paradigms of infinite growth, never stop progress, always more money, and why is this unrealistic? And what have been the detrimental consequences of this neoliberal linear way of understanding our civilization, with both Clinton and Trump, and also Obama and former Clinton president, and Bush and Reagan all fully believed in infinite growth. It's ours to capture, manifest destiny. The form is yours.
The thing is, it's not just that the last several presidents that we've had have believe in this notion of linear growth, this notion of progress leading us inevitably onward and upward to the stars. You know the rhetoric. This is our religion in America. I mean, conservatives say America is a Christian country. America isn't a Christian country. America devoutly believes in the religion of progress. Go into a church on a Sunday, odds are if they're not ranting about politics, they're talking about how we can make a better world, and of course the world's going to be better in the future, blah, blah, blah. Come on. This is a faith-based idea. In point of fact, as you noted, civilizations have a life cycle. They're born, they rise, they plateau, they decline, they fall. you have a dark age cycle and a new civilization begins. This is normal. Okay. The only reason this is even controversial at all is that we've got this frankly religious ideology of progress that leads people to go, well, not us. It's different this time. We're destiny's darlings. We're special. We're not special. The thing to keep in mind, I mean, that's kind of the general overview. You've got these cycles. They've been going on since civilizations, meaning urban literate societies, first emerged about, what, 5,000 years ago. And it's a normal thing. Some of the thinkers you mentioned, I'd add Giambattista Vico, I'd add Arnold Toynbee. There's been many, many historians who have traced this process out and said, okay, yeah, there's this nice little cyclical process you can predict. Once you figure out where you are, you can predict more or less what's going to happen. Now, more or less. That does not mean I can tell you, for example, on the basis of a historical cycle, who's going to win the election this November. That doesn't even mean that I can trace out in any kind of precise detail what's going to happen in the next 10 or 15 years. I can give you some general ideas, but you've always got the sort of noise, the stochastic static that gets in the way. Things happen. People make decisions. Random stuff takes place. And that's kind of the background noise. And you have to be able to look through the noise to watch the overall arc that's going on. Here in America, okay, we're still talking about progress. Both sides in the presidential campaign right now have, you know, they're trotting out the usual nonsense about how, you know, they're going to lead us onward and up with the same kind of thing that we've had the last, what, five or six elections. They're not going to, of course. They're simply going to preside over the next phase in the decline and fall of the American empire. But they can't say that. They can't even say, okay, the U.S. is in trouble. We've backed ourselves into a corner, and oh, have we? Here are some things we can do to kind of extract us from that corner. Nobody's willing to talk about that. Donald Trump, to a very limited degree, is willing to talk about a couple of the things that we've done that might possibly help. Hillary Clinton, as far as I can tell, her entire strategy is, okay, let's take everything we're doing and just keep on doing it pedal to the metal. Now, where does that leave us? Where that leaves us is a set of policies that have been frozen in place since the first Clinton administration. Giveaways to the rich, punitive austerity to the poor, monomaniacal military intervention overseas, but malign neglect of our infrastructure at home. You can check off the thing. You can check off the boxes. That's a bipartisan consensus. Both parties are into it up to their eyeballs. Nobody, you know, within the Beltway in D.C. is willing to look at any change to that. Nobody in the political class is willing to bite the bullet and say, okay, these things are running us into the ground, even though they are. Even though many people realize, okay, something is wrong here. Many counties in the United States can no longer afford to pave their roads. I mean, the U.S. is reverting in many ways to a third world country. People know this. People may close their eyes to it, but they know this. And yet the only option that's presented to us by the political system is pedal to the metal straight on ahead in the direction we're going, because that's progress. Because, you know, we've got to do that because we're doubling down on choices already made, and it's running this country into the ground. That's kind of the very basic overview.
Okay, I just, in the last program I did, I added up our total debt, student debt, credit card debt, mortgage debt, uh-huh. corporate debt, pension debt, unfunded, funded debt, uh-huh. and the total debt came to about $170 trillion. Our gross domestic product, our income, was $18.4 trillion, uh-huh. and yet we are condemning the rest of the world for not doing more austerity checks, meaning taking uh-huh. away people's pensions, lowering them, firing public workers, privatizing private assets, waterways, mm-hmm. Shipyards, airports, and even privatizing water and electricity mm-hmm. in countries that have never had that. And yet we in the United States, we say we're the model, we're exceptional. We are 900% debt to gross domestic product, the worst in the world. We mm-hmm. thought Greece at 225%. Italy at 274 and France at 224% debt to gross domestic product were basket cases. We're 900%. We mm-hmm. can never get out of this. And yet their whole premise is just keep cutting down the forest, keep making the genetically engineered food. Do you see the massive contradiction between what we posture and what we posit and what we actually are?
Oh, of course. Of course. Yeah, and that's this is actually absolutely bog standard for an empire in decline. What the thing that nobody wants to talk about is that what props up the United States economy is tribute from overseas. We've got a situation where the 5% of us in the United States use roughly a quarter of the world's energy, about a third of its manufactured product, and about a third of its raw materials. Okay? That doesn't happen because we produce some good or service so marvelous that everyone else is willing to give us the wealth of the world in exchange for it. It happens because we've got military bases in 123 different countries. It's a tribute economy, and it happens because we at the moment, a global empire. That's causing immense flows of wealth caused by unbalanced systems of exchange that flow into the United States that give us that paper capacity to run up our national credit card, as you say, to 900 times of our capacity to pay. Of course we're a basket case. Every empire is in its last days. And so that fixation, that notion that we're exceptional, we're the indispensable country, again, more noise, more nonsense. Britain used to say that in the days of the British Empire. You know, the British Empire is indispensable. They ran themselves into the ground actually not quite in exactly the same way we are, because they saw it and backed down. They had the brains to realize that their empire was bankrupting them, and so they let go of their empire. And that's why Britain has had a relatively gentle decline from its imperial peak. You think of the last global empire that did that, which was the Spanish Empire. Spain, in the wake of its imperial period, it went through civil war, it went through massive economic depression, like centuries of political, economic, social turmoil. Spain was reduced to a complete basket case before it finally started picking up again. And even then, you know, it's had a long, rough road because they wouldn't let go. We're not letting go. We're doubling down on empire. We're running up the national credit card, as you said, to absurd, obscene levels. And at the same time, insisting that, well, you know, everyone else ought to cut back. Everyone else ought to, impose these various austerity measures. The sole reason for that is so they can keep on funneling more wealth to us, so that we can live high on the hog in the style to which we have become accustomed for a little longer. How long is that likely to last? That's the $64 trillion question, if you will. It's very hard time. I mean, it's as hard a time the fall of an empire as it is to time the collapse of a stock market bubble. You know it's going to collapse. When? That's the challenge.
Could you give us your observations on the Judeo-Christian myth and theology as a major contributing influence in this linear, non-liberal view of progress?
Well, basically, that's really crucial, because what happened is, over the last several centuries, a lot of people who had been raised Christian or, you know, within the sort of Christian worldview ended up unable to keep believing in the Christian theology and in the Christian creeds. But they still had the emotional needs that mythology once filled. And so they applied the same kind of thinking to progress. Okay, we have the Judeo-Christian idea. The world was created, according to the Bible, in 4004 BC, or more or less. Okay, it was created. There's this linear course of history with the incarnation of Christ. It's kind of in the midpoint, certainly the dramatic midpoint. And then you reach the apocalypse. You have the events of the book of Revelation, and it ends. It's a straight line. It's a straight line with hard endpoints. So here's the beginning, you know, here's Genesis, here's the book of Revelation, here's the straight line in between. Everything chugs through that once, and then it's over. I'm not really sure why that notion became so popular, but that was the notion of Christian theology. That was the notion that our culture grew up with. And so people applied that to the notion of progress, except with one change, of course. There is no end point in the myth of progress. The religion of progress has it, you know, we're onward and upward toward a Star Trek future, endlessly metastasizing across the stars. It's the same linear thinking. It's the same notion that you can just keep on going in a straight line and pow. The flip side of the myth of progress is the myth of apocalypse. The notion that history is a straight line extending to boom, the end. However the end is conceptualized. Think of the whole method, the whole business around December 21st, 2012, which I think we might as well call Nothing Happened Day. An enormous number of people bought into that on the conviction that there had this linear notion of history. There had to be some kind of big kaboom, whether it was a kaboom destroying the world and annihilating all of humanity, whether it was a kaboom of destroying our limited understanding of the world and releasing us into utopia, there had to be that big Book of Revelations, blam. It didn't happen. It never does. I actually published a book in the run-up to 2012 called Apocalypse Not, which ran through some of the thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of apocalyptic prophecies that have been trotted out over the years, claiming that the end is nigh. And it was really kind of depressing to write that, because watching intelligent people convincing themselves of this linear myth with an end point. So, you know, we've got these emotional needs. And as long as people aren't willing to reflect on that and take a hard look at how they're letting their emotional needs shape their idea of history, how they're letting their emotional needs blind themselves to the cycles of history, and the fact that, you know, the universe ultimately doesn't care what kind of narrative we put on it, it's going to go ahead and do what it wants. We're going to get people who insist that, well, of course we're going to progress endlessly off into the stars, or of course, you know, well I think the current date of apocalypse is supposed to be 2030, you know, that's when the big boom's going to happen, what have you, and miss the actual historical changes that are happening around us right now.
Is there a particular empire in history whose trajectory towards failure and collapse best parallels what you see as the stages of collapse in our industrial civilization?
I would say, there's a lot. There are a lot of options. There's been a lot of civilizations. The one that I think is closest here is the ancient Maya, because the Mayans, like us, depended on the exploitation of a non-renewable resource. In their case, it was their particular way of farming, which stripped the topsoil. Okay, so topsoil was their non-renewable resource, and they ran through it the same way we're running through fossil fuels. And all the other non-renewable resources were exhausting. And so they had this, you know, basically this long, slow upward rise, and eventually this really quite dramatic peak with, cities scattered across the Yucatan, the mathematics, the astronomy, all of these amazing creations. And then over a period of about 150 years, they crashed and burned catastrophically. There was about, 95% population loss over the course of that rolling collapse, ending with ruins ruins covered by the jungle. Now, there were still Mayans left. There are still Mayans left today, but they're not building cities. And one of the problems when you base your entire civilization on the exploitation of non-renewable resources, and when those resources are gone, you're screwed. And down you go. So the decisions back in the 18th century that committed us to a civilization based on fossil fuels, coal originally, then coal plus oil, then coal plus oil plus natural gas, those have basically set in motion a process that is going to have a fairly ugly outcome over the next several centuries.
What could we reasonably understand the relationship between global warming, torrential rain, in fact, a new form of rain we've never seen in recorded human history called rain bombs.
Mm-hmm.
I just read that for the first time about a month ago,
mm-hmm.
where 22 people were killed in one day because so much rain came down at one time.
Mm-hmm.
It simply drowned people. And then you have drought. In
mm-hmm.
fact, we just got a report this week that we're now seeing a 900-year drought in the Middle East, and there's no end in sight.
Mm-hmm.
We see that only 1% of the world's water is actually usable, and that's diminishing substantially. We see aquifers in the United States being diminished, including Agalaga, the largest
mm-hmm.
aquifer in the United States, over the 7-8 corn and wheat states.
Mm-hmm.
We are also seeing the rise of sea level, and they're predicting this next 12 to 24 months, we will see the first Category 6 hurricanes. We're seeing more tornadoes, larger than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
We also had the first 2-mile tornado. 2 miles. We'd never seen it before, just this year. So when you have a day that was 162 degrees in Iran just a month ago, never before, and you also see at the same time whole cities are without electricity for periods of hours a day, what can you predict fairly fairly objectively at this moment for the next, let's say, 5 years?
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, that's one of the places where we have screwed ourselves so thoroughly. I don't know if the English language has adequate words for it. People have been warning about this specific thing since the late 19th century, okay? And more specifically, back in the 70s, there was a lot of discussion about the simple fact that if you treat the environment like a sewer in which to dump waste, you're going to get blowback. This is the blowback. Is that going to accelerate in a linear fashion? Watch that word linear. No. It's going to accelerate in a completely unpredictable, random, a word that your audience may or may not know, stochastic method, where the stochastic method basically means just stuff happens at a faster pace, and it happens in all directions. This is the thing that the talk about, quote, global warming, unquote, missed completely. It's not linear. It's not you add more heat, everything gets warm. The Earth's atmosphere is a heat engine. It's powered by the sun. The heat circulates through the Earth's atmosphere and radiates out into space. The more the effectively the heat is trapped by an increasing layer of greenhouse gases, the more energy you have in the engine, and that means the more, the more extreme all weather phenomena become. You get your Cat 6 hurricanes, you get your gargantuan tornadoes, you get more droughts and more rain in different places. You get more chaos. I'm not generally fond of Thomas Friedman, but in one of his books a little while ago, he really scored one by commenting, what we're facing is not global warming, but global weirding. So what we can expect is increased unpredictability in the climate, increased unpredictability in the weather. Is your town going to get hit by a rain bomb? There's absolutely no way to know, but towns are being hit by those. We, downstate in Maryland here, just a little while ago, we had a town just flattened. There were only a few deaths, but the entire downtown of Ellicott City was torn up by torrential rains and flooding. This is going to happen more and more often, and the place you want to watch is the economic impact, because all of these things impose costs on the economy. All of the, you know, drought, whether it's drought or flooding, whether it's really big hurricanes, really big tornadoes, shifts in climate belts, horribly high heat, all of this costs you. It costs the national economy, it costs the global economy, and it costs your pocketbook personally. And that rising economic burden is the thing that actually does the damage. There was a report, this is about 20 years ago now, one of the big reinsurance companies noted that at the current rate of increase of climate-based disaster claims being made to insurance companies, the total cost of repairing climate disasters was going to equal the total global annual output of the global economy by about 2060. Now, obviously, that's not going to happen because the global economy will go bankrupt first. But we really are facing a point that where the blowback from our own idiotic mishandling of the biosphere is becoming a massive economic fact, a fact that is going to affect everybody's pocketbook, everybody's daily lives.
That said, what characterizes a dark age, and what are some of the primary indicators you notice today in the United States to give you reason for alarm that the nation is heading into a new dark age? Chris Hedges would argue that it is our culture of spectacle and illusion that has moved America's society to a dark age, or worse. So what are the other fundamental characteristics you observe from the historical record? And finally, you state that a viable culture is one that succeeds in giving meaning and direction to a society in the context of its own environment. Would you please elaborate further upon this, and how would you assess the social meaning that mainstream corporate media and the political institutions tries to infuse into the citizenry, and what's the ultimate effect?
Oh, wow. Okay, that's about 4 books worth of question. I'll do what I can. Okay, first of all, what we call a dark age is simply the natural endpoint of a civilization. When a civilization runs through its resources, goes through its life cycle, crashes and burns, then you bottom out. And here's the funny thing. Civilizations are very different. when you're actually, when you, you have a civilization going, you have different art forms, you have different cultural forms, religious forms, political and social, and all this kind of stuff. They're all very different. Dark Ages are all the same. To an astonishing degree, Dark Age cultures around the world are roughly the same. You've got subsistence agriculture, you've got government by warlord, you've got generally a very low population, and the route there is usually not very pleasant, but you've got a situation where there are not many, there's just people are few on the ground, social forms are very simple, and technology is what you can cobble together yourself. And so how do we know that we're heading there? Again, get outside the media bubble. Notice the fact that, you know, again, counties across the United States are no longer paving their roads. Our infrastructure is falling to bits. All these things that maintain the veneer of of what we think of as ordinary life, these things are breaking down around us. If you can imagine the end point of that, extrapolate it as far as possible to the point that, you know, when the sewer system's shut down, when the power, when there's no power coming out of the, you know, the plug in the wall, all of these things, no, this is not going to happen all at once. It's going to happen a little bit at a time. It's already happening as hundreds or thousands of people in cities across the country over and over again every day are being cut off from power. They're being cut off from water because they can't afford it anymore. Or because the systems are breaking down, and, oh, I'm sorry, you know, we're going to have to limit your power use because we're doing a brownout, we're doing a blackout. As this accelerates, we end up heading down the curve toward a dark age. And there are things you can do about that. The one thing you can't do is prevent it. Once we're in this cycle, we're already, as you said, we're already fantastically over our heads in debt. We can't simply keep on running business as usual. And so business as usual is going away around us. Watch that trajectory. Again, get out of the media bubble, pay attention to the facts on the ground. You'll see we're already well in the process of decline. Now, the worldview, the manufactured pseudo-culture of, you know, the American corporate life churns out all of the, you know, I mean, there was a time when children read or listened to stories that were actually being produced, either traditional stories, fairy tales, Mother Goose rhymes, things that were part of tradition, things that were being created by authors for some reason other than to advance corporate interests and sell product. You don't get much of that anymore. We've gone from Mother Goose to My Little Pony. And it becomes, we have this vast corporate pseudoculture being churned out by people in faceless office blocks for the sole purpose of keeping people hooked on business as usual. If you look at that culture, you'll notice it has the basic structure of a television show. That is to say, nothing changes. You know, something, you start the episode, you introduce some kind of problem, blah, 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 things happen, and then you end it in the same place you started. So that the next episode, the next interchangeable episode can do the thing. People are stuck in that idea. They're stuck in the idea, okay, well, you know, we have this problem, we will solve it within the next 28 minutes in time for the closing credits and the music to roll. And because we're stuck in that mindset, because that mindset is profitable, because it keeps people from asking hard questions about where we are, how we got here, and whether any sane person would want to be here, that stuff gets churned out. One of the things that inevitably happens in the descent toward a dark age is that those narratives, the canned narratives of a society, break down, partly because they no longer represent facts on the ground, partly because people get sick of them. If you look at, say, the fall of the Roman Empire, Rome had its favorite narrative. Our favorite narrative is progress. Their favorite narrative is you have, you know, a world in chaos, and then a strong figure rises up and establishes order, and everything's fine forever. That was the basis of their religion. That was the basis of their politics. That was the basis of their philosophy. You know, this move to from chaos to enduring order. And of course, when in the fall of the Roman Empire, when the enduring order had become was falling apart around them, people just kind of looked at that and went and started telling different stories because it didn't work anymore. In the same way, we're not there yet. We may not be there yet in 5 years. I don't know when. Again, it's like trying to time a stock market crash. The belief in progress, the faith that going further in the direction we're already going will lead us to heaven on earth, the mainspring of the American psyche, that's going to crack It's already cracking in places. And when it goes, when people realize that, that history is not leading us in any particular direction except at the moment straight down, that and that's just a temporary thing, you know, that there is no guarantee of a better world. The Star Trek future is not going to arrive. There are no replicators. There are no tractor beams. You know, just all of this garbage that we filled our minds with is just a set of self-indulgent fantasies. When that actually sinks in, I think this country is going to go through a pretty fair equivalent of a collective nervous breakdown, because we've put so much of our heart into this delusion of endless progress.
I would share my own personal perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I spent 5 years traveling the United States, filming people who were under all media and social institutional radar. I found, by my miscalculations, that there is no economy in the United States. There are 9 separate economies.
Mm-hmm.
And we pay almost all of our attention to the top 3. That is the uber rich, the very rich, and the newly rich, and how they can motivate other people to get their wealth. In other words, work like I do, watch this show, buy this product, support this stock. But what is not shown, not discussed, not highlighted at all are the people. For example, there is a town in California, in the San Joaquin Valley, that is the cantaloupe capital of America. It normally holds about 12,000 people. It has no water. The water was gone, and the state didn't provide any for its allotment, so it literally had to go out and dig up all those patches, and now those people have no work.
Mm-hmm.
They are living in destitution.
Mm-hmm.
I saw 16,000 homeless vets near Titusville, Florida, living in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
No one around them in the suburbs helps them. They don't want to see them, so the people know they have been rejected, and hence they try to stay invisible by being in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
There are all the people, for example, when I was in New Orleans, an old building there, one of the old 1920 buildings, I think it was a theater, now it's used as a homeless shelter, and I got there in the early afternoon, and I saw people sitting down a street, down another street, and around a block. Probably, I'm guessing, around 1,000 people. What were they there for? Because at 7 o'clock that night, they would allow a certain number in. It turns out it was about 40. 40 out of 1,000
uh-huh.
who could have a meal and sleep there that night.
Uh-huh.
And no one talks about him. But
uh-huh.
one of the people I interviewed had been a former accountant, and he now lived there and helped inside the residency, but he was homeless.
Uh-huh.
We have 30 million Americans who have lost their homes, 8 million homes, 4 per home. It's around
mm-hmm.
30 million people.
Mm-hmm.
But they're couch surfing. They're living in family and friends' basements and,
mm-hmm.
and
I know people
even
who
in
are
Florida.
Doing that, yeah.
And other people are just trying to make ends meet. We only count the people in city shelters. That's not 1% of the actual homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And so we
mm-hmm.
don't think the problem's that big. So on the one hand, I'm seeing people who are living as if they're in an economic, cultural, social dark age now,
mm-hmm.
right now, and have been since 2007.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to share that perspective. I did a documentary called Poverty, Inc.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And the thing is, I think it was William Gibson, the science fiction writer, who said the future is already here. It's just not widely distributed yet. And so, yes, these people are living in the opening rounds of a dark age. That's what a dark age looks like. And they're the early adopters, if you will. And so one of the things that will happen is that the people who make that transition sooner, some of them, those who manage to land on their feet and manage to find ways to get by, they're actually the ones who are building the real future. Well, the folks in Silicon Valley are dreaming about flying cars and dreck like that. The real future is happening with, you know, these homeless vets in Florida. It's happening with the very large. I don't know if anybody has any idea how many people there are at this point who have gone. They're off grid. They are no longer being recorded. They have dropped off the economic radar screens completely. Sometimes because they had to. Sometimes because they chose to, and you know are living in little. You know, various kinds of little shelters tucked away in the woods or something, and getting by on a combination of foraging, under the table work, whatever it takes. There's a lot of that these days, and they're the ones who are actually building the future. One of the pieces of advice that I have been giving people for some years now, and it really does seem to be helping out for a lot of people, is this: collapse now and avoid the rush. I know that sounds kind of trite and also kind of scary, but the thing is, if we're already on our way, if the United States is already on its way down, and it is, very obviously, being poor, living in a third world country, takes a certain amount of skill and a certain amount of practice. You cannot just walk out of your nice, cozy suburban lifestyle into that kind of setting, into an impoverished setting, and easily land on your feet. The more you contract your lifestyle now, the more you give up the perks, the more you give up the expenditures, and put the money you save into things like developing skills, the more easily you'll make the transition. And that's, this is scary. I mean, I find, many people will just, the thought, well, I mean, most Americans, there's this fantasy that Americans have, that Americans are strong and independent and, they don't care what other people think. They just go and do what's right. We are the most class conscious, the most terrified of conformists in this country. And the thing that scares most Americans more than anything else is, what if somebody thinks that we're poor? Oh my God, that's the thing. For many, many Americans, that's the thing that terrifies them more than anything else. The fact, if somebody were to think that they were a little poorer than they are, it's the end of the world. Well, sorry, sweetums, you're going to be a lot poorer than you are now. You are already objectively poorer than you were earlier, not necessarily in income, but in terms of the amenities, goods, and services that income can effectively buy. Poverty is on its way. You might as well get used to it. You can learn to be capable, competent, effective at being poor. It's possible to live on a lot less than most Americans live at this point and get by comfortably and have a decent life. Most people in most of the world do that. And we're very spoiled in this country. And so collapse now and avoid the rush is one of the very few strategies that allows people to get ahead of the curve, set aside some money, put some time and energy into developing the skills and the other things that they can use to surf the wave of decline and fall rather than having the floor just drop out from under them.
John, there was a time when I was young that I had a great aunt. She was a vegan. She ran a farm over in Little Hocking, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And during the Great Depression, all of my mother and father's brothers and sisters lived on her place. Mm-hmm. And she was not liked because she was a disciplinarian. Mm-hmm. And she taught them that you've got to waste not, want not, mm-hmm. Prepare for the future in a reasonable and responsible way, and you don't need to live outside of your means. So she had this wonderful farm, and today it would be considered the most perfect farm. She had like over 100 varieties of fruits and trees. Mm-hmm. She had nuts, and she had vegetables. She had a root cellar. Mm-hmm. She had herbs that she knew all about, and she would put them in brown paper bags and tie them, label them. She dried tomatoes, and mm-hmm. and she had barrels filled with grains and seeds, all just this one little wiry woman. And mm-hmm. I happened to like her. I thought she was so much fun because she was always doing something. She believed in focusing on the solution. Mm-hmm. And when I asked my mom, what was it like for you to live there? She says, well, she had us up early in the morning, and we worked all day, and half of everything we made that day, we were told, give it to strangers, the hobos who came by, generally on a rare mm-hmm. Train, because mm-hmm. they have nothing. So what mm-hmm. we have a place to sleep, we have water, we have shower, we have food. They don't have anything. Mm-hmm. And so give to a stranger. And I was thinking when you were talking, my mother, the greatest generation, mm-hmm. helped us, the baby boomers, instill us with a sense of character and community. And I remember growing up where all my clothes, every single thing I wore, were my older brother's. And my younger brother's was everything I wore. She just kept taking in everything. Outside mm-hmm. of our shoes, everything else. And mm-hmm. we never thought that we were deprived because we didn't have a lot of stuff. Then I remember going to, and one of my, I said, what was the biggest message? She said, well, she said, we didn't have a lot of material things, but we had happiness, and we had each other, and we learned to live within our means. We conserved everything. And she said they even at times would use candles instead of electricity to save on that because everything was rationed. But she said my great aunt never had to use a ration card. She would give it to other people that were in greater need because she was 100% off the wire and self-sufficient. She had a windmill. They pumped their own water. Now, take that example of not just her, but millions of Americans who got through the Great Depression by saving, by living without, by adapting to what they did have and sharing. And then today's young person, the cupcake generation, the millennials, they are going to have a really rough time. So could you give us an understanding of how the generations and their conditioning and beliefs and values, they each have a different capacity to adapt, as you suggested we have to start doing, but they don't adapt to anything.
Well, no. Be careful about that. One of the things that you need to remember is that many of these people who had to buckle down and do things the way your great aunt did during the Great Depression, they were living a wild life during the 1920s. The 1920s was a very flush time in this country, and a lot of people were doing the kind of thing that millennials do now. Okay, the flapper generation. Okay. And then the stock market collapsed and the economy shut down, and all of a sudden the School of Hard Knocks was open for business. And, you know, people figured it out. It so happens that I have a lot of millennials who, who comment regularly on my blog, The Archdruid Report. And I also know a lot of people in the millennial generation. Yeah, there are a lot of people who deserve the term the cupcake generation, but I've met a lot of younger people, millennials and even younger than them, who are... They get it. They know that they've been screwed. They know that they will never have the kind of things that their parents and their grandparents' generation have. That has all been flushed down the toilet by half a century of really idiotic American economic and political policy. And they get that. And many of them are actually making coherent preparations. You know, they're not the ones that catch the media. These are not the, you know, the cupcake, you'd hear about the cupcake generation. That's what hits the media. That's the narrative that the media wants to push on you. Underneath that, I know a lot of young people who are learning how to garden, if they don't know it already, who are learning how to knit and sew and do productive crafts like that, who brew really good beer. And do not, that's one of those things. One of the things I recommend to people, if you're going to start anywhere, learn how to brew beer. If there is ever a complete collapse, okay, Attila the Hun rides up to your door, hand him a cold beer. He's your friend, okay? So people, they're learning skills. They're learning the things that will help them get by. And the others, the ones who are doing the cupcake generation thing, the ones with the overwhelming sense of entitlement, they will have that knocked out of them when the next round of economic troubles hit, just as the flapper generation got what kids today call a clue by four upside the head once the stock market crashed, and all of a sudden all this abundance, all this, you know, cheap money, jobs readily available, went away for what, a decade? For the Great Depression, and the warriors, of course, there were plenty of jobs, but not much else. So, you know, don't discount the millennials. They've actually got a lot going for them, and a lot of them are aware that they have been dealt a very, very bad hand by the generations that precede them.
I fully agree with that. I want to take you in a slightly different direction.
Sure.
Because no one is paying attention to the Middle East as far as the oil they have, and the fact that Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and United Arab Emirates and Qatar, they've been living high on that hog. And they have also used so much of their resources for defense and for regime change and for very, very wrong reasons. But we have been giving them all the breaks in the world. They can harbor terrorists. They can promote a terrorist value with Wahhabism. They can support al-Qaeda and al-Nusra and ISIS and ISIL. They can go into the poorest country in the Middle East, Yemen, without any political consequences from anyone. and they can treat women so badly, and all because they have the oil money. But is there a time to where they could also go through their own collapse, where that oil is not plentiful, at least the cheap oil? And why don't we ever hear anyone discussing this?
Well, here again, you've got to get outside of the media bubble. This kind of thing has been talked about in the peak oil scene at great length. Yeah. Saudi Arabia, in particular, is in deep trouble right now. They have been pursuing a policy trying to crash the price of oil to drive competing producers out of business. It is not working. With Iran now being able to sell its oil on the open market, Russia has regrouped and is functioning. Venezuela is going to pot, but they're only one, and the Saudis are going bankrupt. They are running through their currency their currency reserves at a fantastic rate, and that's one of those things. You never know. It's like trying to time the market. But I would not be at all surprised to wake up one of these days and find headlines saying that the Saudi government has fallen, that a revolutionary government is in power in Riyadh, and the world is going to be a very different place. They reek of the kind of situation you saw in France right before the French Revolution, Russia right before the Russian Revolution, a lavishly overfunded, clueless royal elite, sitting on top of a powder keg and completely unaware of it. So I expect major explosions there, probably in the very near future.
See, the average person doesn't understand what you just said in one context. Maybe you could explain a little differently. 2 years ago, Saudi Arabia had $960 billion reserve fund. That's a huge amount of money, but no one understands. Where does that get spent? How much is it spent? How much is replenished? Why did they have to borrow money just last year? Why did they have to start selling partnerships? And what's happening to their social contract with their own citizens, where they're now charging for what would previously have been free? And how long are people going to accept something that they have to pay for when historically it was free without revolting?
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And you've also, the question is, Saudi Arabia said that it has $960 billion. How much of that money is actually there, and how much of it has been quietly pocketed by one prince or another? It's a very corrupt society, especially at the top end. The Saudis say they have X vast amount of oil. There have been analyses of their oil reserves that suggest they have much less than they claim, that they're very nearly scraping the bottom of the barrel. And so absolutely standard. If you know your way around pre-revolutionary societies, this sense of the glittering facade with not much behind it's totally familiar. And so, the Saudis. I mean, if they have $960 billion in their currency reserve, as you say, why are they selling bonds now? Why are they going into debt to pay the government operating expenses? That says to me that they are actually much shorter on cash than they claim. And selling off portions of Saudi Aramco, engaging in all kinds of stuff like that, they show every sign of being a regime on the brink of collapse. Now, how long? Good question. But it's very much one of those things where you watch and say, okay, what cannot be sustained will not be sustained. Sooner or later, this puppy is going down.
Okay. Going back to the Clinton White House, there has been a consistent and steady eroding away of social services in America to improve the lives of those at the bottom of the ladder, and this has only gotten worse. Today, you mentioned that some people don't have water and don't have electricity on a regular basis. I could take you to areas of Chicago, I could take you to Detroit, to Flint, Michigan, where they do have water, but they can't drink it. So today, the success of Trump and Clinton is attributed to a large percentage of people who view the American system as fully rigged against them because it favors an elite class that you mentioned, and that today lives by a different set of laws and rules than anyone else in our society. Mm-hmm. The consequences, our culture has become divided and fragmented into a postmodern caste system. You mentioned it earlier, and I thought very appropriately so, that we are a very rigid society, and we We're fearful. Our moves are based upon fear. So when a so-called democracy reaches such a stage when citizen participation is little more than a ritual performed only during election years, what are the deeper causes?
Okay. One of the historians who studied social historical cycles that I mentioned, Arnold Toynbee, discussed this one in great length. One of the things that he really focused on was the way that leadership in a society breaks down. A successful society, every society has some kind of an elite class, okay? But in a successful society, the elite is open at the bottom. People who are talented, people who are competent, can work their way up into it. And the other thing is that in a successful society, the elite actually solves problems. That's what wins them the loyalty of everyone else. You have somebody like Franklin Roosevelt, who comes into office and says, okay, we're actually going to fix things. And were there problems with what he did? Of course, but he actually put shock paddles on a prostrate economy and more or less got it going again. And so that won him immense loyalty because he actually did something. What we have now is a situation, again, where Toynbee describes that basically the elite stops solving problems. They stop. They instead of solving problems, they talk around them. This recent stuff, you had Obama and Hillary Clinton both insisting, no, everything is fine in America. That is the voice of an elite class on its way to the guillotine. Once somebody says, oh, we don't have any problems, all of our problems are solved, everything is great, and anyone who says otherwise is just whining, blah, blah. When you have, as you've said, millions of Americans who are homeless. You have millions of Americans who do not have enough to eat. You have millions of Americans who don't have basic services like water and electricity. Things are not great in America. Things are not doing well here at all. We are sliding down. Let's take this one really simple measure. When I was a kid, a few years ago now, when I was a kid, a working class family with one income could own a house, could own a car, could get all the basic necessities of life, and maybe even a few of the luxuries now and again. Today, working class family with one income is on the street. There's been an immense shift there. Nobody wants to talk about it. Things are not okay in America, and when you get the class, when you get the situation where the elite class is insisting, no, everything's fine, we just need to keep on more of what we're doing, and, if you think otherwise, shut up, which is basically what Hillary Clinton's been saying. That at that point, you have the division, what Toynbee calls the schism in society, into a dominant minority and the internal proletariat. The internal proletariat are the people who have to carry the burden of supporting society and receive basically none of the benefits. And at that point, they no longer have any reason to be loyal to the dominant minority. They have no reason to be loyal to the society. They're not getting any benefit from it. They're expecting to carry all of the costs. Well, the dominant minority lives high on the hog. This is a recipe for social explosions. And usually there are various ways that it can play out on the way down. But once you have that schism opening up, once you have a leadership that will no longer solve problems, and the rest of society looking at saying, okay, so why should I care about this society? Why should I care about the values that this society supposedly has but doesn't actually act on? Things are going downhill very, very quickly once you hit that point. That's the point that we're at. I think, like him or not, and, admittedly there's a lot not to like, Donald Trump was speaking to that when he's talking about making America great again. He appealed to people by talking about some of the issues that you're not supposed to talk about, like immigration, like offshoring, various things like that. That's why he steamrolled all of his Republican opponents. And the fact, if in fact he goes down in flames in the election, he's not going to be the last person to do that. Every aspiring demagogue in North America has got to be looking at this whole thing and saying, here is a path to political power. And so, can the dominant minority, can the elite class do anything? Sure. This is what happened in 1932 when FDR came in. The situation was exactly the same. the Hoover administration had responded to the stock market crash in 1929 and the further economic unravelings by saying, well, you know, we just have to suck it up and deal with it. They were refusing to actually do anything about the problems. And things were moving very close to explosion in this country. People gave the political system a second chance, or one more, another chance. FDR got in and actually started trying to address the problems. And we had the rebirth of national unity that enabled us to fight and win the Second World War. Could somebody do that again? Maybe. But somebody actually has to do it. It's not enough to sit there in D.C. and insist that everything is fine. And you know, anyone who says so is just whining, or you know, that way lies destruction. That way lies the collapse of this nation and a long, bitter period of turmoil and chaos.
I really appreciate this hour. Thank you very much, John Michael Greer, for being with us. And we appreciate the understanding of America's new dark age and what we can do to be honest about it and realistic and try to make changes. All the best, and thank you for spending your time
with us. Thank you for having me on.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. This has been Conversations with Remarkable Minds.